The text for this morning's discussion is from what has become, over the past week or two, my favorite book entitled A River Runs Through It. I guess those of you who were going to be on the mine hike with Rudy, you're in the wrong place. He left 10 minutes ago. Very deep, this one. The book is about fly fishing, and I thought that I would read a passage in memory of Rudy and Lloyd, who attempted unsuccessfully to teach me yesterday and the day before. I was setting the fly so fast, I was taking it away from the fish before they could get a hold of it. Every different kind of trout is on a different speedometer, and the correct timing will vary also with the stream and even the weather and the time of the day. I had been fishing too long in the fast water of the Big Blackfoot, where big rainbows charge out from behind the fortresses of big rocks. And I wasn't used to this other kind of fishing. Some early rancher had planted the elkhorn with eastern brook trout, and as the name suggests, they are a more meditative type of trout than the other kind. Once I got my timing slowed down, says McLean, I lost interest in them. They are beautiful to see. Black backs, yellow and orange spots on their sides, red bellies ending in underfins fringed with white. It's a lesson in ethnic kinds of conversation. They are compositions in colors and were often painted on platters, but they are only fairly good fighters. And they feel like eels because their scales are so small. Besides, their name is against them. In western Montana, where the word brook is not a socially acceptable substitute for creek. All of a sudden, I wondered what my brother was doing, because I knew he certainly wasn't wasting time catching his limit of 10-inch eastern brook trout. If I wanted to stay in shooting distance of him, I'd better start trying to catch some of those brown monsters that work their way up from the Missouri. Fishing is a world created apart from all others, and inside it are special worlds of their own. One is fishing for big fish in small water, where there's not enough world and water to accommodate a fish and a fisherman. And the willows on the side of the creek are all against the fishermen. I stop, clean my eastern brook trout, and arrange them in my basket between layers of wild hay and mint, where they were more beautiful than those painted on platters. Then, in preparation for big game, I change to an 8-pound test leader and to a number 6 fly. The other day I said that there were at least in my opinion, 5 challenges to black theology. Let me repeat those 5 challenges and then proceed to try to unpack or unload them for purposes of our discussion this morning. The first challenge, I said, was to reaffirm the wholeness and the solidarity of the black community. And the second challenge was to remove and oppose every vestige of sexism. And the third one was to resist the seductive materialism of American imperialism. And the other one had to do with dealing with a rampant classism that tends to demean the aspirations of the oppressed peoples in this country and of the world. And the other one was to defeat or to speak effectively against the new spirit of sectarianism that impedes rather than encourages the unification of the Christian family in general and of the black church in particular. Those were the five challenges. We had dealt with one of them, and now we'll try to continue with our discussion on sexism. Those of us in the black community and the black church have too often treated our women with the same kind of disdain that the white community has. On the one hand, we have celebrated the traditional nurturing role of the black mother. And of course, the black mother has received an awful lot of notoriety because of her amazing capacity for affection, even under the absurd conditions of oppression. She has been enshrined by American culture as a kind of Aunt Jemima. Aunt Jemima, the picture of the lady on pancakes and grits and other material that's used in the kitchen. The black church has participated in this by creating mothers' boards and ladies' aid societies. And just recently, I understand the black preacher came up from Los Angeles to speak at the ALC convention, and said that the reason that his church was successful is that he kept the women in their place. And that became a kind of a note for indicating the success of the church. It's a story related to me by Mary Schramm 2 or 3 days ago. Recently, black women have rightly formed a chorus of protest to decry the audacity of black males in particular, and of men in general, who would make women the, quotes, backbone of the church without really allowing them to participate in some of the more useful functions of the body. Unfortunately, too many members of the black church community have accepted the patriarchal structures which have governed many societies for centuries. Even black theology, with all of its intense commitment to egalitarianism, must confess that the movement has, until recently, paid little attention, if any at all, to the questions of the place and the role of black women in the church and in the theological discipline. In a book that Zitalele and I mentioned at yesterday's discussion, Black Theology, A Documentary History, you will find recorded there the first writings of black women as they attempt to reflect on black liberation theology, American style. Jackie Grant would be one. Were you at Union when she was there, Larry? Oh, she came after you, I believe. Very, very gifted black woman theologian, wrote the first piece, and there are several others. One of the most moving sections of that book is entitled Our Mother's Garden. That represents the first attempt of black women to give evidence to the fact that they too are not only capable of embracing some of the abstract thinking of theology, but have some rather practical and useful correctives to build into it. The liberation of black women then from the belittling and sterile tentacles of sexism is something with which black theology must contend. The love of the black sisters, however, within our development has brought us to a new awareness of our complicity in perpetuating sexism. We accept this challenge to set our own houses in order. We pledge to commit ourselves with the help of our sisters, to bringing our best insights and skills to a new and sincere exploration of this area. There is a dialogue presently between white women theologians and some black women theologians. I'll just share a couple of sentences from that dialogue and move to the next section. With the emergence of articulate white women theologians and with the genesis of the white feminist movement, the question gets asked often, what is the place of black women in that struggle? Jackie Grant would say that there are options which white women have which black women don't have. They are obvious ones, but oftentimes in the discussion they are not considered. White women are the man's wife, the man's mistress, or the man's daughter. Therefore, finding out about the man from white women theologians is necessary, but the debate as to whether or not black women are women first and black second, or black first and women second, is something with which they, meaning black women, are wrestling, and not necessarily with us, but with each other. To obliterate this fractionalizing of the union extant between black women and black men is one of the challenges to black theology. The pernicious challenge that our renewed awareness of the degenerate impact of imperialism upon non-white societies is something that we also should address. We believe that imperialism receives its greatest psychic nourishment from racism, sexism, classism, nationalism, and sectarianism. I'll talk about the others in a moment. Each of these ideologies have fed upon one another because they all have their roots in the strange and tragic conviction of white Western people that they are somehow the guardians of all that is ultimately right and good in the world. Now, this sense of superiority gets filtered down into social arrangements, national politics, ecclesiastical politics, and relations in time of scarcity. This network of ideologies is summoned to serve, we believe, the expansionist interests of the few so that they can rule the many. Black theology sees the new challenge, which an era of scarcity presents an opportunity to alert the masses to see the whole picture and not respond to systemic oppression as if there were only individuals doing wrong rather than a rational social, economic, and political arrangement that is questionable. We turn to the gospel for guidance, and we readily encounter the Jesus reminder. In the Sermon on the Mount, that is, it is more blessed to give than to receive. We search for social and political arrangements that enhance this idealistic tenet rather than ignore it. Imperialism, classism, and sectarianism are ruled by the principle of self-interest and not the principle of giving. We believe that the new challenge that faces the church as well as black theology is to call these demons by their names and rebuke them forthrightly and quickly before they destroy the human community. I've been learning in Bible class how to do those kinds of exorcisms while at the same time laughing about it. There are some presuppositions for our vision. The challenges that confront black theology stimulate rather than depress us. In spite of much that militates against these visions. We have refused to engage in those famous or infamous Ain't It Awful sessions. We are a people of hope. A plug for next year's theme here at Holden. But our hope is based on certain presuppositions granted us because of our particular situation in time and in space. We recognize that the bankruptcy of modern civilization compels us to project a vision of the future that is informed but not limited by our particularity. We have learned an awful lot from our dialogue with African brothers. You've heard a little bit of that with the conversations going on between Zitalele and myself and other black theologians. The challenges that now confront us, sexual, class, imperialist oppression, along with our traditional concerns with racism, shape and mold our particular vision of the future. Our vision is informed by four fundamental moral convictions. These moral convictions flow from the distinctives of the black theological perspective. First, we believe that racism is morally evil. In modern times, racism has been legitimated by the doctrine of white supremacy. Now, this is abominable doctrine, and it continues to infect the already cancerous core of modern Western civilization. Second, we believe that the class-ridden, capitalist productive arrangements of society is morally evil. The capitalist system of production is regulated by the principle of maximizing profits and consequently fosters an immoral distribution or a maldistribution of wealth within and without countries under its sway. Third, we believe that sexism is morally evil. Male domination over females, in both its benevolent and malevolent myriad forms, preserves the myth that the nuclear family is sacred because its existence, nurture, and protection is the chief justification for the marketplace and the state. Despite renewed affirmations of this seductive credo by conservative Christians, most notably in the activities where I call it Falwellian theology, we see the propagation of this ideology as unsound theology and moral regression because it denies the legitimacy of human dignity and freedom in every area of human relation, especially within the intimacy of the family itself. Last, we believe that imperialism is also morally evil. As children of black slaves, who are among the first people to become victims of Western imperialism, we pronounce this conviction as natural champions of human rights. I say among the first victims because there were other victims who were first, and we all know who they are. The thin civility of Western civilization masks, we believe, the grim racist and narcissistic values undergirding this society. What has been paraded as enlightened political and social order has often been a shameful disguise for some of the most brutal and sophisticated imperialistic policies and actions and political gerrymandering in world history. In fact, white denominations have participated in the domination of the colored peoples of the world. And this has been one of the telling consequences of the imperialistic maneuvers, church style. Moreover, modern white subjugation of the third world has not created and will not create the kind of climate that we call the climate constructive to dialogue. Indeed, white subjugation of the third world was not created ex nihilo. It has very pronounced domestic roots. White Westerners often project on an international scale what they first practiced at home. In other words, the tentacles of the system, this system of production, has been literally projected into the third world. And it often parades itself as friendship, but it's a powerful form of rationalistic, sexual, racial, and classist self-interest. We believe that this system seeks the economic and often political domination not only of wealthy countries over poor ones, but also the domination of particular minority people within the national borders of imperialistic countries in order to depress the labor market and use unemployed and so-called unemployable minorities as hedges against inflation and other forms of greed. We believe that the tentacles of this present system render core segments of the world's economic order captive of the principle of maximizing profits, hence reinforcing an immoral maldistribution of wealth in the international community. Because we are convinced that the system, not the people, is evil, we search for ways to resist its forces. Our strategy is undergirded by something far more fundamental than righteous reactionism or glib ideologies. We have a religious vision of gargantuan proportion. Our vision is guided first and foremost by our determination to preserve and enhance the activist heritage of the single most important agency of social change in Afro-American society, the Black Church. The Black Church, we believe, with the exception of some of the things that I have just pointed to, is still the only voluntary, classless institution in American society. The only one. Happens to be the only thing that black people own outright, unless they're Lutherans, or in some cases Presbyterians and Anglicans, then you're owned by the company store. But the Black Church has been traditionally one of the few places where the local chicken thief and the local doctor can sit on the same pew and serve the same God and not be penalized for it. In most oppressed black communities in the United States of America, the Black Church is the hub of those communities and their constituent families. And we have to, in the black theological discipline, acknowledge that and take it even more seriously than we have taken it in the past. That inextricably bound to the welfare of oppressed people is the black church, because the church is people. Now, systems of production, political process, and cultural lifestyles have value insofar as they permit us to preserve and enhance our communities, churches, and families, as well as the welfare of all oppressed peoples of the world. We believe political systems, economic world orders, and lifestyles only have substance when they serve as means to fulfill the capacities and potentialities of human beings. Even after saying this, however, I am acutely aware that our vision cannot be adequately expressed in the dead, impotent rhetoric of a dying civilization. We are in search of a new language, as well as a new economic, political, and social arrangement, which cannot be impregnated by the very words we presently have to describe and anticipate it. The reality we foresee cannot be postulated by language which presupposes the higher reality of a pristine world of ideas in defiance of the body's constraint. The powers and principalities of this world do indeed have bodies. We believe those opposed to these powerful governments and economic conglomerates cannot afford to build edifices of words. We scan the globe not for a new order of rhetoricians, but cohorts willing to constitute themselves into a working fellowship dedicated to the overthrow of degenerate and powerful individuals, corporations, and governments who laugh at the golden rule, but most importantly, fly in the face of the theology of the cross, the chief ethical cornerstone of the Lord's kingdom, we believe, theology of the cross. Nevertheless, we believe that perhaps a very old concept like the kingdom of God comes closest to describing the new day which oppressed peoples of the world yearn to see. And you can hear that in all of the slave songs if you listen carefully. We strongly disagree, however, with those who believe that God's kingdom resides outside of human history. We got handed that one once. Hyland Garnett said that came from the big house, and we did it. The spiritual center. I got shoes. You got shoes. All God's children got shoes. But when we get to heaven, we gonna put on our shoes and dance all over God's heaven. Now y'all don't have to worry about no shoes, no robes, no nothing down here. Because when we get to heaven, we're going to do that. Heaven, for some who sang it, was north of the Mason-Dixon line. Heaven, for many who sang it, was a release from this, quote, veil of tears, where God would receive us unto himself in heaven. And there we would get our shoes. Lou Stokes came to our church to speak for the 50th anniversary and tells a story about some blacks who had been exposed to the truth of the black spirituals and to the truth of liberation theology. And it appears that some blacks went to heaven and some went to hell, which then constituted a kind of a dialogue between heaven and hell, similar to the rich man, poor Lazarus story. But anyway, it appears that the phone rang in heaven, and the devil was concerned about the uppity, liberation-oriented blacks who had come to hell. Well, God was equally concerned about the liberation-oriented blacks who had come into heaven. God said, these people are really creating problems. They want, all of them want three-piece suits and Italian pointed-toed shoes and nice cars to drive. They don't want any Volkswagens, because those Volkswagens were symbols of affluence in America. As soon as blacks were able to afford Cadillacs, the symbols switched. they wanted to stick with Cadillacs and so forth. And God was complaining because the kind of demands that the blacks were putting on the rulers of heaven were just impossible to meet. And the devil apparently said, well, God, you think you have problems. Boy, have I got problems. These liberation-oriented blacks have invaded hell and put out the fire. We can now see the globe in a different way than we have ever seen it before. It is still a world that's a swirling mass of things with very little nailed down. But we somehow believe that the Lord's kingdom exists inside of it and not outside of it. And that the things that we yearn for are here and not there. Nevertheless, we believe that perhaps a very old concept then, like the kingdom of God, comes closest to describing this new day that we have. We further believe that it is the process of becoming. And we believe that black people become as primary in the agent category as any group of this grand transformation eventually. Therefore, despite the inadequacies of this concept and our present descriptive powers,
we can identify two features of this new order theologically. First, this new order should be international in scope, based upon a system of production regulated by the moral principles of satisfying the basic needs of all peoples. Paul Haynes says that's impossible. All right, we shall see. On the national level, this system of production will look something like a socialist configuration in which there is class equality and a relative egalitarian distribution of resources, even wealth. On the international level, the coordination and cooperation of particular systems of production of various countries should promote a relative egalitarian distribution of the world's resources. Second, the new order should promote the human dignity of all peoples. No more Norwegian jokes.
Aww. Come on.
This promotion should take the form of protecting the liberties and freedoms of minority peoples within national boundaries. Now, that's an interesting statement. Do you know who the minority people are when we start thinking of an international order? Yeah. Mahmoud Baraka did a little poem that describes the world as it is, not the way it's been pictured. The poem goes something like this. Black people, 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 brown 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 people. Brown people, brown people, brown people, brown people. Red people, 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 red people. Yellow people, yellow people, yellow people, yellow people, yellow people, yellow people, yellow people. Oh God, yellow people, yellow people, yellow people, yellow people, yellow people, yellow people, and others. So when we speak of protecting the minorities. Well, let us say that that statement could be an appeal to the enlightened self-interest of all of the inhabitants of Holden. Now, anyone acquainted with our history knows most Afro-American leaders have always seen their struggle in concert with the struggles of our fellow oppressed brothers and sisters around the globe and in this country. I described in the first session the encounter between whites in Appalachia and Andy Young, didn't I? I think I talked about that a little bit. We have never believed that our refusal to fall prey to parochialism should lead to our own self-effacement and disembodiment. We strive for unity and cooperation with other oppressed peoples, including those persons who are oppressed by their need to oppress. Martin Luther King used to always say, and people had difficult time figuring out what he meant, and he said, you know, I'm not trying to free black people. That's not my primary objective. My primary objective is to free white people. And to help them to see that they are not free until we are free. We are free. A person who has to make me wait last to eat or not let me eat at all. A person who has to make me drink from a colored fountain. A person who has to make me, quote, stay in lodging that's substandard, that person is not free. So we strive for unity and cooperation with other oppressed peoples without becoming victims of a superficial homogeneity. We know we need friends because we dare not delude ourselves into believing that the powerful concede anything without resistance. That's a sad statement, but it's a statement which is all too true. Now a word, a concluding word, which in my opinion is a good word, because it at least challenges me, and I hope that it'll challenge you. Last two decades of this 20th century indeed may be the most turbulent, distressing, and challenging years that we have ever faced as black people, white people, or peoples of the world. Thus, the ultimate test for the Christian witness of black theology, our particularity, will be the vision and praxis it promotes as the coffin containing the corpses of a system that has outlived its usefulness is lowered into the grave. Furthermore, as the proponents of the hypocritical universalism of white theology scramble to find their meritorious place in that lifeless pit, we look unto the hills from whence cometh our help and strength in the struggle against injustice. And every now and then, some of us will take time out to go fly fishing. Let me read another statement here from McLean. As a Scot and a Presbyterian, McLean's father was a Presbyterian minister, my father believed that man by nature was a mess and had fallen from an original state of grace. Somehow, I early developed the notion that he had done this by falling from a tree. As for my father, I never knew whether he believed God was a mathematician, but he certainly believed God could count, and that only by picking up God's rhythms were he able to regain power and beauty. Unlike many Presbyterians, he often used the word beautiful. Now, this is the final passage. After he unbuttoned his glove, he would hold his rod straight out in front of him, where it trembled with the beating of his heart. Although it was 8.5 feet long, it weighed only 4.5 ounces. It was made of split bamboo cane from the far-off Bay of Tonkin. It was wrapped with red and blue silk thread, and the wrappings were carefully spaced to make the delicate rod powerful, but not so stiff that it could not tremble. Always it would be called a rod. If someone called it a pole, my father looked at him as a sergeant in the United States Marines would look at a recruit who had just called a rifle a gun. My brother and I would have preferred to start learning how to fish by going out and catching a few, omitting entirely anything difficult or technical in the way of preparation. That would take away from the fun. But it wasn't by way of fun that we were introduced to our father's art. If our father had had his say, nobody who did not know how to fish would be allowed to disgrace a fish by catching him or her. So you too will have to approach the Art Marine Presbyterian style. And if you've never picked up a fly rod before, you will soon find it factually and theologically true that man by nature is a damn mess. But learning how to fly fish is at least a beginning in straightening out the mess.
The thing that bothers me about Jared Falwell and his church in Lynchburg, Virginia, and the whole moral majority position is not they have positions on ethical questions, that they, in some way, say, claim to know the will of God on questions that I don't think someone knows the will of God, that they seem to me to be political questions for debate. One is on an economic system. These people have religified capitalism. God is obviously a capitalist for Jerry Falwell. They do it all over. You know, how many guns you're supposed to have, it becomes a question, a theological question. And that troubles me very. I don't like that. Now, when I hear you making statements about what black theology says about systems, it seems to me that you are doing the same thing with Marxism or socialism. It's not quite. Or other things as well, and I would like you to comment on that. Or if you think, maybe you think you ought to do that. I mean, I'm not.
Well, I don't think that. Well, Nyeri said that Ujamaa, this was he was describing, his system does not seek either the imprimatur of the Holy Bible or the Holy Quran. It's not looking for those kinds of imprimaturs. It becomes a practical and realistic way of the people of Tanzania working out for themselves a familiar system that, quote, works for them. I know that I'm not totally capitalist and I'm not totally socialist. That may make me a Christian. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't think that you heard any Marxist ideology in my statements. It was not my intention to quote Marx. Although there are some things about Marx that I really like. There are one or two things about George Washington that I like too, and Bancroft and those people. Every now and then, these people could say some things that, in my opinion, would have redeeming social value. I'm just convinced, Julie, on the basis of my 40 odd years as an American, that there are some things in this system, at its core, that just aren't working. And that it's throwing other kinds of things which might work into tailspins. I think that there are three, at least I'm familiar with three views of history. There is the Bancroftian view of history, which most Americans still hold. Things run pretty much in a straight line, you know, from Plymouth Rock to, quote, American Samoa. And built into that is a kind of a manifest destiny theory. It was the will of God that we land on Plymouth Rock, civilize Indians, you know, exterminate them, enslave blacks, make stoop laborers out of Asian people, convert Indians. It was the will of God that all of these things should happen. And God picked us to do it because we've got a better way of doing it than anybody else.
Oh God, who has given us this great land for our own, you know, and because it did become the most powerful expression in the world, and I guess legitimately the police person, the policeman of the universe, people think that it ought to be it ought to work everywhere. That premature expansionist doctrine, however. Unclothe some other kinds of things. We are talking about then a system that was built over the backs of slave labor, aren't we? And we are talking about a system that has raped and robbed and pillaged the entire known world. And ethically, theologically, when one examines that kind of system, one has to look for something else. Bill Stringfellow says, yes, you know, a theological examination of the system makes one want to throw up, as it did Flower Children and others, you know, and then they look for alternative ways of doing it, only to return to Wall Street later on. Colin Morris was writing his book about that one, on young, uncolored, non-poor. The people get you all eventually. Maybe they'll get me too. Maybe they have me already. I don't know. But I do believe that there is something else that can be fashioned. And it has to be fashioned now as a result of dialogues between equals, not monologues among unequals, and definitions which people of color in this country and people of color in the world have had nothing to do with, like integration, for example, those kinds of things. No, the system has not worked for us, the Bancroftian view of history. Then there's the Marxian view of history. And we some of us are familiar with that one, you know, the spiraling kind of thing. And then I say that there's my view of history, which I believe is the view of history that most ghetto folks have. What goes around comes around, unless you deal effectively with it for the first time. And that's why, you know, most people are shocked. By God, the Klan is back. You know, and the Klan seems to arrive on the scene about the same time as Jerry Falwell. Let me say there's a key.
All the swastika painting.
Yes, yes, yes. All of these things arrive at the same time, which means that, you know, all you got to do is look at some 1955 to 65 footage, and you've got a replay of the whole thing, except that the ties are wider or smaller. I don't know what. Yeah, the ties are smaller. It still form, at least for us, some rather fashionable hangman nooses. But the thing is back, and it's more sophisticated than it was before. With the impending economic crises. Comes also what we call the Bacchusizing of America, with the increase in power configurations being digested. There comes now some concern for the antiquatedness and the uselessness of the Voting Rights Act in America. Something is rotten in, I was about to say Denmark, but I shouldn't.
No, don't say that.
I shouldn't say that. I should say something is rotten in Washington. Now, because I speak that way, that does not mean, well, let me just say, most people who understand these systems know that Marxism is not working in Russia either. In fact, all the real Marxists are either dead or underground or exiled from Russia. Russia is a prima facie case for state capitalism, I guess the word would be. So we're not looking to Moscow for no system. and we're not looking to Washington for no system, I guess, and we're not drinking as much as we used to either. Who was it? It was wretched of the earth person. That's a good question. Franz Fanon said, "What happens to the grass when two elephants fight? Two white elephants? Well, you can try to drink and make them pink." Or you can try and relieve yourself. Well, if salt 2-3 works, same thing happens to the grass if two elephants make love, I guess, too. Somebody else said, some great philosopher. But we're not looking to those things as alternatives. I suppose that where we are is someplace that I can't describe, but can only be described as a result of constructive and creative dialogue, and the beginning of which always happens, and has happened here at Holden ever since I've been here. There are times when there is not a cessation of that dialogue. I just think we got to keep talking until we come up with a language that describes what it is that we want. Maybe the kingdom is totally out of this world. Larry.
Your agenda for black theology, or challenges to black theology, with the substitution of one word, and number one, reaffirm wholeness and solidarity of the black community, put in some other community, is also the challenge to feminist theology,
yeah,
as I read it,
yeah,
and some other and,
yes,
and Native American theology,
yes,
and
yeah,
so there's all kinds of room for alliances there. It's the same challenge, and I want to ask about. I don't think it's another number six, but I want to pursue something just for a second with you there. I remember when reading Eldridge Cleaver's book Soul on Ice, his comment that Chubby Checkered was a white hero because it was the first person that put white folks in touch with their bodies.
The Twist, it was called.
Yeah. And
it was also a simple dance. You didn't have to paint feet on the floor to. excuse me, Larry.
Arthur Murdoch. But and what I hear you talking about now in answer to Julie's question is what I would, I think, maybe rephrase a little bit differently and say that a crisis is a crisis of industrial society, which has assumed that the earth or creation is essentially loose hardware, which has viewed that in mechanistic terms, and which has a sense of the earth being infinite, kind of a flat earth view, infinite in extent. So you just in a species chauvinism of humanity being able to kind of do with the planet what it wishes, and then as soon as you can get certain categories of human beings in some level lower with you, then they become part of that way of viewing all things mechanistically. What I'm asking is whether in black theology and in the traditions that feed into it, including the African tradition, whether there is a sense of affinity of all things to one another, so that you don't have a mechanistic view of the world, but you have a sense of a single, I don't know if I should say household, but of everything being connected to everything else. And one way is to discover yourself as bodies in the world with an affinity to all other things living, and now the scientists tell us that there isn't really much of a significant line between the organic and the inorganic. I mean, everything really is connected to everything else. And so, I guess I'm asking whether you see in the traditions that feed black theology also something which might be helpful if one senses that it's industrial society in crisis in its picture of seeing things, and that as an alternative has what some folks would call an ecological consciousness about it. That's beyond both industrial socialism and capitalism, because Marxism has also been mechanistic in the way in which it's worked out its system. In fact, one of the most telling things that I've ever read about Marxism was that Lenin had on some of the early Russian factories portraits of Henry Ford in those factories because of the adulation of that kind of technology because of its capability of
And he should
production.
Have had pictures of Walter Reuther on in the factory, but he Ford would have been, yeah, he was kind of a hero.
Yeah.
Well, the whole question of how you humanize the machine is something that we're honestly and conscientiously wrestling with. The question of how you put feeling into the data that's pumped out of it is something that we're wrestling with. The only real response that I can give you to that, Larry, is that we are open for dialogue on that one. We believe, I don't have time to share my dream of how the president's cabinet ought to look, but you can imagine what my dream is. I did that in other places. Black theological reflection is only a part of what we call the whole. The native people, indigenous people, however, they've been teaching us an awful lot about the care of the earth, for example. An awful lot about how when you see a waterfall, you don't think of how you shut it off and turn it into hydroelectricity. Oh my goodness, you know what I just said? But you think, I guess, before you shut it off and turn it into hydroelectricity, you think about a cosmic and divine reality in water falling, and that'll do something to you. And then even as you make use of it, your use of it is tempered by your having experienced it. The native people say that the earth is our mother, and the sky is our father. Well, you know, the gravity doesn't feel. You know, if you jump off of a building, you don't break the law of gravity. You break your neck. But the earthboundness of our experience, and learning that, you know, that it's our mother, tempers the way we will treat it. And I guess Ujamaa and the spirit there is the only African example that I can bring to fore on how you do that. I think that the Zimbabwean experiment will also tell us some things. But then in the meantime, we still have to, I think, rely on those people who were capable of breaking the outer crusts of the earth, making one small step for man, one giant step for mankind. We'll have to rely on them putting in their kind of thing too, because we still going to send a tractor to Zimbabwe, aren't we? Huh? Now, the question of whether or not we Holden sends a tractor to Zimbabwe to tear up the earth, you know, conquer the earth, or whether it's going to, it's not a contradiction in my opinion, Larry, but it's a paradox. That's not quite a contradiction. It's one of those things that I guess you have to live with until we figure out whether or not God is fooling with us, you know, doing some hoaxes on us, or whether or not he's playing hardball, to use Zitalili's phrase. That's an excellent question. I don't think that black theology has thought beyond the points that I've delineated here, but it must, I think, continue to go beyond those. We'll have to see what will happen in our dialogue with feminist theologians, and in our dialogue with what we now call sensitive white theologians, who want to argue with us, come through with the thesis antithesis thing, and then we'll all have enough sense to grab synthesis when it falls out of the many explosions between thesis and antithesis, and that's I guess that's the value of conversation. Most importantly, though, black people have always said, my grandmother taught me this, two things you don't fool with: Mother Nature and Father Time. And if that becomes, you know, the kind of principle by which you govern yourself, then it's conceivable that you'll avoid hurting somebody or forcing somebody into hurting you. The authority. Tress?
Mother Nature and Father Time.
Mother Nature and Father Time.
Yes, says it's
12. Says it's 11:46. Time to stop.
We have 5 minutes.
Time runs when you have fun. More questions?
Well, yes. What I sort of heard you saying is that you're not really saying that you found any concrete answers, but you found some questions to discuss that we need to work on together, because what has happened to us has have not been beneficial to any of us.
Precisely. All we're saying is, well, to quote Jesse Jackson, the problem has been in America that white men have been running everything. You'll pardon me, fellas, if I'll just go and tell the truth. They've been running everything. If you look at General Motors, for example, they ran that. You know, and they built everything that works. But see, the problem is that when you keep building and building and building and building, and you keep coming up with new ideas and new ideas and new ideas, and you're kind of inbreeding, you know, this male thing, then you pretty soon you run out of ideas. And it's like, finally the women said, you ought to build cars in more colors, and then we'd buy more, you know, other than black and white and gray. Yeah, I mean, you know, that was, but for years they just did them that way, you know, because that was what you did. And Jesse Jackson says, now they are out of ideas. And what do? Punish the Japanese.
Yes.
Now, what I'm doing is I'm trying to agree with what you're saying. Yes, we have to keep conversing and sharing ideas, but except that the ideas now have to be among equals, not among a caste of inferiors and a caste of superiors.